asshole! And shoots the driver the finger. I shield the setting sun from my eyes with the back of a hand and say, I don't even want to hear it. Into the phone. It's hard to hear Henry over the commotion of the city, but I make out the sound of his laugh, loud and obnoxious, like nails on a chalkboard. Hello to you too, Wood, Henry says, and I have visions of him on the commode making this call. His pants are down around his knees. There's a magazine spread across his lap. Playboy. Kiss that pretty wife of yours goodbye. We head out in the morning. What now? I ask, and he says, Roadshow, Denver by way of New York. Damn, I say. It's not that this comes as a complete surprise. We've been preparing for this dog and pony show for weeks. But still, Heidi is going to be pissed. The train ride home is quiet. I depart the L at Fullerton Station and walk down the steps onto the street. There is a homeless man leaning against the cast iron fence beside the newspaper stands, eyes closed as if he's fast asleep. Beside him sits a black garbage bag, stuffed full with all of his earthly possessions. He shivers in his sleep in the biting 50-degree day. My first thought? Those big legs of his, long and gangly, lost in a pair of light blue hospital scrubs, are in my way. Like the other people moving down the street, I step over him with exaggerated strides. But then something makes me stop and turn, to see the redness of his cheeks and ears, the way he's got one hand on that garbage bag in case someone tries to steal it in his sleep. I pull my wallet from a back pocket and search inside, forcing the sound of Heidi's voice from my mind. I drop a $10 bill beside the man, hoping the wind doesn't carry it away before he opens his eyes. It'd be just my luck if my good deed went unnoticed. When I come into the condo, the TV is on. Sesame Street. Heidi's got that baby laid out on its stomach in front of the TV, and she's educating Willow about the fine art of tummy time, hoping the big furry monsters distract the baby long enough that she forgets how much she hates being on her stomach, floundering around like a fish out of water. Zoe stands in the kitchen, eyeing her cell phone on the counter. She jumps when I come bumbling through the door, as if caught red-handed doing something wrong. She ebbs slowly away, one step at a time, before Heidi can see her proximity to the phone. Heidi greets me with, I thought you were going to be home sooner. She barely raises her eyes from the baby, who she inundates with all sorts of shrill baby talk and overblown facial expressions. But for me? Nothing. It's nearly 7 o'clock. Can I speak to you, Heidi? I ask, as I hang a jacket on the hook by the door. Her eyes graze mine as she lifts that baby from the floor and hands her to the girl, who handles her so maladroitly that for a split second I think the baby may fall. And then that stupid woolly mammoth is on the TV, Aloysius Snuffleupagus, and the girl stares, dumbstruck. And it occurs to me that Zoe hasn't watched Sesame Street since she was about 2 years old. Heidi follows me into the bedroom, her feet light as air on the hardwood floors. Mine, in contrast, are heavy, clobbering the floor as if I have something to prove. The cats scamper away, so I won't step on their tails, and hide under the bed. While I change out of my work shirt and into a white and maroon sweatshirt, my old alma mater, of course, go Phoenix, go, I tell her about the road show, about how I'll be in New York for a day or two, followed by Denver for a few days, how I'm leaving in the morning. I'm expecting a lashing, fingers wagging and eyes rolling, some dismissive comment about Cassie Knudsen, a grilling about whether or not that floozy will accompany me on this trip. And yet, none of it comes. She's quiet for a split second, and then Heidi simply shrugs her shoulders and says, Okay, and goes so far as to heave the laundry basket downstairs to make sure I have plenty of clean undies for my trip. I should be concerned. I know that. But not being reprimanded like a 10-year-old boy is pure bliss. I pack. I warm up leftover pizza for dinner while Heidi gathers quarters and excuses herself to throw the laundry in the dryer. Zoe is in her bedroom, working on earth science, or so she claims. But I see her instead on her bed, with that yellow notebook across her lap, the one where she keeps her intimate thoughts about how her father's a doofus, her mother a loony. Or maybe in that notebook she writes about Austin, or maybe Willow. How would I know? Maybe, just maybe, she's a closet poet, filling the pages with limericks and odes. In the room with Willow and me, there's nothing but dead air. And baby noises. Coos and squeals and grunts and such. I find myself staring at the palms of her hands for evidence of a tattoo, the butterfly with its black and yellow wings. I wonder, if she'd had it removed, would there be a scar? Bleached out skin? Leftover remnants of the tattoo? But on her hands, there is nothing. Nada. And yet there are those earrings, the very same earrings as in the Twitter profile. How could that be? I peek to make sure Willow isn't paying attention, and then I check my Twitter account stealthily to see if @lostwithoutyou ever responded to my tweet. No such luck. But I have 8 new followers, a fact that I let go to my head. How would Willow ever reply, I wonder, if she doesn't have access to a computer? Does she have access to a computer? I think about that nasty old suitcase she lugged into our home, the one perched in the corner of my office, the leather cracked and brittle, losing shape. Is there a laptop inside? Some smartphone with Wi-Fi where she could respond to tweets? I've never seen her on it, never heard it ring. The girl has enough trouble handling a remote control. I find it hard to believe she's got a smartphone or a computer. But I don't know. Mine and Heidi's are both password protected. There's no way she's getting on them at night. The girl is staring lifelessly at the TV. I've changed the channel to the news. A roundup of the day's baseball games. It's opening day. I'm guessing she doesn't give a hoot about baseball, but she stares at the TV so she doesn't have to talk to me. She sits far away, as far as she can get, hugging the far end of the sofa, though I'm at the kitchen table, a good 10 feet away or more. She sips from a glass of water, and I watch the way her hand, the water, how they shake, ripples forming on the surface of the glass. "Where are you from, anyway?" I ask. I hate the silence. But more than that, I'm reminded that I'm the only one in this house intent on figuring this girl out. And this, 2 minutes or so alone with Willow, my interrogation uninterrupted by Heidi's watchful eye and regulations, may be my only chance at doing just that. She stares at me. It's not a nervy kind of stare. In fact, it's the exact opposite. Meek. Timid. But she says nothing. "You don't want to tell me?" I ask. She's slow to respond. But then she shakes her head, a movement so subtle, if I blinked, I would have missed it.
"No, sir,"
she whispers. I like that she calls me sir. "And why is that?" I ask. I listen to her response, try to decipher a dialect, but come up empty. She sounds like a standard Midwesterner, like me. Standard American English. Willow says cautiously, her voice so quiet I have to lean in to hear her over the baby's babble,
"You might make me go home."
And I ask, treading lightly, "Is there a reason you don't want to go home?" The news blares from the TV, opening day games giving way to the day's top stories. A brutal home invasion and stabbing on South Ashland that instantly catches the girl's attention. I grope for the remote control and change the channel just as body bags are ushered out of the home on stretchers. I land on home shopping. "Willow," I say again, hoping the accuracy of her name will earn me bonus points. "Is there a reason you don't want to go home, Willow?"
"Yes, sir,"
she admits, picking at the fringe on the edge of a throw pillow. She isn't looking at me. "Why's that?"
"It's just..."
she stutters.
"It's just... that..."
I think she'll never finish that thought, and then she says,
"I don't like it very much, is all."
An inadequate response if there ever was one. "Why not?" I prod. There's no response, and so I ask again, "Willow, this time with a jagged edge to my voice. I'm losing my patience. Heidi will be back soon. An invisible wall goes up around the girl. She doesn't do well with impatience. She needs to be prepped first, like flower seeds needing to be soaked in water overnight for faster germination. She isn't going to open up until we penetrate that outer hull. I lower my voice and turn on the charm. I smile and try again.
Was somebody mean to you?
I ask instead, my voice as comforting as it can be. I'm not known for my compassion, but I try. Her eyes rise to mine, blue eyes that carry much too much baggage for someone her age. The blood vessels swollen, sagging tissue around the eyes, blood pooling under the skin, causing dark circles to form. I'm on the edge of my seat, waiting, desperate to hear what she has to say. She opens her mouth to speak, to tell me.
It's okay, I say. You can tell me.
But then I hear the sound of Heidi's keys jingling in the lock, and I silently will her back downstairs to the laundry room. In vain. Willow jumps at the sound, scared to death by the harmless tinny sound of keys. I see the fear take over her eyes, as the water glass slips from her hand, tumbling to the ground below. The glass doesn't break against the shag rug, and yet water spills. Everywhere. She drops frantically to her knees and begins to clean up the mess, to spot the water with the edge of her shirt, her eyes darting between Heidi and me as if she thinks she might be punished for this little blunder. Beneath her breath, she mutters an incomprehensible jumble about forgiveness and sins. Keys. Keys in a lock. Being locked in? I make a mental note of this. I'm not one to feel sympathetic, but for a split second I feel the slightest bit sorry for the girl floundering around on the floor, praying to the gods for mercy.
Honey, please,
Heidi begs as she retrieves a towel from the kitchen drawer and hurries to Willow's side.
Please, don't worry about it.
I do my part, leaning over to retrieve the glass from the floor. But I see the terror in the girl's eyes, and know that I cannot undo what has been done. We sleep, Heidi, Zoe, the cats, and me, locked in the bedroom. In the early morning before I leave, the sun just rubbing at its eyes and preparing to start the day, I wake and remind Heidi that this is as it should be every night that I am gone, her and Zoe in the room together, door locked. I am out the door by 5, lugging my suitcase and briefcase down the hall for a cab ride out to O'Hare. The girl and her baby are asleep when I go, their own door pulled to and presumably locked as well, my office chair possibly slid under the door's handle for an extra safeguard in case we try to force our way in while she sleeps. The sun is beginning to rise, painting the sky gold. As the cabbie, with his talk radio and the overwhelming smell of a pine-scented air freshener filling the cab, careens down I-90, I lay my briefcase in the seat beside me. I reach inside for a notebook and pen to get some work done on the ride. It's a solid 30 minutes to O'Hare on a good day, and judging by the buildup of cars already on the interstate, I'm guessing it won't be a good day. I toss open the briefcase, and there I see it. A note, scribbled on a purple sticky note, the answer to last night's unanswered question. A note that sucks the oxygen right out of the cab. Handwriting I've never seen. The simple inscription. Yes.
Willow. Luis Flores wants to know more about Matthew and Isaac, my foster brothers. If that's what you call them. The term brother implies some kind of familial tendency, of which there was none. Not with Joseph, not with Miriam, or Isaac. But Matthew. Matthew was different. Sitting there in the meager room across the table from Louise F-L-O-R-E-S, I picture Matthew. Tall, like his father. but with hair the color of chocolate brownies. Mama's chocolate brownies. And dark brown eyes. I imagined that this was what Miriam must have looked like once, long ago, before she became a mousy gray. Isaac, on the other hand, was Joseph through and through, a carrot top with orange hair on his arms, his legs, his chin. "What about them?" I ask, and the lady says, "Did you get along with them? Did they participate in this alleged sexual abuse as Joseph did? Or were they victims as well? What was their relationship with their catatonic mother?" "Catatonic?" I ask. "Yes, in a daze. Unresponsive." She says that she assumes Miriam suffered from a condition called catatonic schizophrenia, based on my description. "If," she says, "what you say is true." As always, implying that it is not. A troll, I think. An imp. I envision Miriam parked in the corner of her room on the wicker armchair, staring into space, while in the room next to hers, her husband did as he pleased. My bedroom shared a wall with Matthew and Isaac's bedroom, and for the first year or so, that alone was the only association we had. We ate no meals together, looked away or downward when we passed each other in the halls of the home. Matthew and Isaac were made to share a room when Joseph and Miriam brought me in, and I didn't know if they liked it or not because no one talked much in that house. Matthew and Isaac spent much of their day in school, and when they were home, they were in their room, doing homework and reading from the Bible. Joseph didn't allow any exchange with me. And he would readily remind Matthew and Isaac that bad company ruins good morals, when their eyes so much as wandered in my direction. To this end, Isaac never changed. If anything, he became more like Joseph as time went on, a lemming ready to plunge off a cliff at his father's request. But Matthew was different. I remember the night, the first time we really spoke. I was 10. I'd been living in that house for almost a year, and in that time Joseph had visited me 2 dozen or more times. I laid in bed well after midnight, unable to sleep as was almost always the case. I was thinking of Mama and Daddy, and rattling off as many I love you likes as I possibly could. And then there were footsteps, outside in the hall, moving along the wooden floorboards to my bedroom door. I held my breath, waiting for Joseph to come in, to slide his clammy body into bed beside mine. I began to shudder as I always did when Joseph's footsteps clambered down the hall, and that, in itself, set in motion a whole slew of things, my heart beating as though it might jump from my chest. The sweaty hands, sweaty everything, the inability to see straight, the ringing in my ears. And then the door slid open, and standing there, in the darkness, was a much different profile than that which I was used to seeing. And the voice was different, softer somehow, tender, equally as scared as I was. "Did you know that cockroaches can live for a week without their heads?" he asked. And then I knew by the sound of his hushed voice. "Matthew." "They can?" I whispered, sitting upright in bed, propped on my elbows in the nearly black room, the only light from a nearby streetlight that flickered off and on. Off and on. All. Night. Long. "Yep," he said. "Sometimes a month. They die from lack of water." "Oh." And we stood like that in absolute silence for a minute or more, and then he closed the door and went into his room. The next day I found a book slid under the mattress of the bed, sandwiched in between the patchwork quilt and a scalloped dust ruffle. A Children's Guide to Insects and Spiders. I knew it was from him. When Joseph went to work and Matthew and Isaac disappeared down the street, joining the other kids at the bus stop, those kids who heckled them and called them names, I sat on that bed of mine and devoured the book. Mama had sent me to school back in Ogallala, and that school had taught me to read, and Mama used to make me read to her every night before bed, everything from her fashion magazines to the Julia Child cookbooks to the mail. I was a good reader, I wolfed down that book from Matthew on the very first day, and then slipped it back into his room under his bed before he and Isaac, or Joseph, got home. I learned everything I could about earwigs and mantids, cicadas and damselflies. I learned that horseflies live for 30 to 60 days, that queen bees hibernate in the dirt in winter, that periodical cicadas only appear every 13 or 17 years. A few days later, a new book arrived, Sea Anemones. I read how they looked like flowers, but really were not. Instead, they were predators of the sea. They didn't age like other plants and animals. They had the ability to live forever, to be immortal, the book said. That book taught me how the sea anemone injected venom into its prey, and how that venom paralyzed the prey so the sea anemone could swoop fish, shrimp, and plankton into their carnivorous mouths. I didn't like those sea anemones one bit. So pretty and celestial, and yet assassins. Would-be murderers in delicate, angelic bodies. It didn't seem fair. It was a trick. A trap. An illusion. A few days later, rocks and minerals, and then another book, and another. Nearly every week Matthew was slipping another book from the school's library under my mattress, Charlotte's Web, and the Diary of a Young Girl, and from the mixed-up files of Mrs. Basil E. Frankweiler, which I read in the moments that I wasn't cleaning house or bathing Miriam, or making tuna salad sandwiches for dinner. Every now and again, Matthew would pause by my bedroom door in the middle of the night, along the way to the bathroom, or to the kitchen for a glass of water. I got to know which footsteps were Matthew's, and which belonged to Joseph. Matthew's footsteps were light and airy as they moved down the hall, then hesitant as he closed in on my room, as if not knowing whether or not they should pause by my bedroom door. Joseph's, on the other hand, had their minds made up. They were coming to my room, right through the white door without a second thought or a moment's hesitation. Matthew pulled the door open carefully, so it wouldn't squeak, while Joseph flung it straight open, never mind if its bellowing woke someone in the house. Matthew stayed a couple seconds, at best, and would offer some tidbit of information that really I didn't give two shits about, and chances are he didn't either. I came to understand. It wasn't about the information itself, but the exchange. A pact. A bond. I was not alone. One night, "Did you know a crocodile can't stick out its tongue?" And another, "Did you know nothing rhymes with orange?" And I admitted that no, I didn't know that, and spent the rest of the sleepless night trying to come up with something to rhyme with orange. Something so that I could tell him about it the next time he passed by. Orange. Yorange. Florange. Nope. Nothing. "Did you know Venus is the hottest planet? Its surface can be 450 degrees Celsius. That's over 800 degrees. And I kind of just stared because really, I didn't know much about Celsius or Fahrenheit, and in all honesty, I was starting to forget all about Venus. It had been so long since I'd sat in a classroom back in Ogallala and learned about the planets and weather and all that. The next day there was another book. A book on astronomy. One night Matthew passed through and said to me, "Did you know my folks get almost $20 a day to foster you?" "What?" I asked. I'd never heard of such a thing. From who? I wondered if the money was coming from what little money Mama and Daddy used to have, or if my caseworker was paying my fare. But in the near darkness, Matthew shook his head and said, "From the good old state of Nebraska, that's who." He stood in the doorway in the plaid pants he wore every night to bed, and a white undershirt with yellow stains down the front, 2 inches too short for his lanky body. "Lily, too?" I asked, wondering if Paul and Lily Zeger were making $20 a day to care for Lily. But Matthew said no. "Not when you're adopted. The Zegers had to pay for Lily, like $10,000 or something." "Huh?" I asked, disbelieving. $10,000 was a lot of money. The Zegers bought my Lily like you'd buy a shirt at the store. I didn't know how I felt about that, if I was supposed to feel good that they'd fork over that much money to own my Lily, or if I was supposed to feel bad because she was just like any other commodity you might find at the supermarket. Clothing. Peanut butter. Bug spray. I wondered if one day, if I ever had more than $10,000, if I could buy my Lily back. Or maybe one day the Zegers would want to return her, like a shirt that didn't quite fit right. Maybe one day Lily would be for sale again, and I'd figure out a way to buy her myself. But what really rubbed me the wrong way was that Joseph and Miriam were getting paid for keeping me. They didn't buy me like the Zegers bought Lily. How do you know? I asked. He shrugged like, duh. I just do. And then he closed the door and walked away.
Why didn't you ever try to run away? Asks Ms. Flores.
By now, the man in the corner, the guard, has leaned in, and I know he's wondering the very same thing. Why didn't I try to run? I glance at him, his brown eyes prodding me on from behind a navy uniform that looks like something his dad should be wearing. Not him. He is a boy, not a man.
Well, they say, those eyes, why didn't you?
I was scared, I say. Scared to stay, and scared to go. God would be mad at me if I disobeyed Joseph. That's what he told me. That's what he made me believe. I knew that there was no way I could go. Not at first, anyway. Not that there was anywhere to go. But if I left, Joseph would do something to harm Lily. That he told me nearly a million times. And if by some chance he didn't, then God would send his thunderstorms and vultures after me, and I wouldn't stand a chance. He'd turn me into a salt pillar, drown me with a flood. I was a kid, I remind her. Before going to live with Joseph and Miriam, I believed in Santa Claus, the Tooth Fairy, the Easter Bunny. Until I lost a canine tooth, that is, and stuck it under the pillow on my bed and waited all night for one of the shiny gold coins the Tooth Fairy used to leave me back in Ogallala. But she didn't come. I made believe she couldn't find me, there in that house in Omaha, that she was flying all over Ogallala looking for me. And then I started to wonder about things back home, in the prefab house on Canyon Drive. I wondered if another family had moved into that home, into my home, and if some other little girl was sleeping in my bed, the one with the hot pink quilt, with orange polka dots all over, and lacy indigo curtains Mama had made with fabric she found on clearance, though they didn't match a thing. I wondered if that little girl was hugging my favorite stuffed purple kitten, all wrapped up in my hot pink quilt, reading aloud from my favorite picture books with her mama, awakening in the morning to find my shiny gold coin tucked neatly under my fluffy pillow. I told Matthew about it one night when he passed by my room. I told him how the Tooth Fairy couldn't find me, how I was still holding onto that shiny canine tooth, how I didn't know what to do, how to get it to the Tooth Fairy so she could use it to build her gleaming white castle in Fairyland.
Fairyland? He whispered.
And I told him how the Tooth Fairy used all those millions of teeth she collected to build a shimmering castle and village for her and all of her fairy friends. And they called it Fairyland. He just stared at me dumbly, like he didn't know what to say. And then he kind of stuttered.
There ain't no Tooth Fairy, Claire, he said.
It was quiet for a real long time. And then,
throw it away.
And just like the day Mama and Daddy died, a little part of me died, too. I was too scared to ask about Santa Claus and the Easter Bunny, but when Christmas came and went, again, with no presents, I knew the reason. And it wasn't that I'd been a naughty girl that year. Days later, Matthew left a new book under my mattress, a book of fairy tales.
Goldilocks and the Three Little Pigs. Rumpelstiltskin. But the one that interested me the most was the story of the Pied Piper of Hamelin, the tale of a funny-looking man who played his magic pipe to lure the children away from town. They were never seen again. I envisioned Joseph, dressed like a medieval jester from the pages of the fairy tale book, in a motley coat and tights, playing his pipe up and down the streets of Ogallala to lure the children from their homes. Children like me. I wasn't sure what scared me the most about living with Joseph and Miriam. Joseph with his hawk eyes and aquiline nose, or the vengeful god Joseph told me about, or the things he said he would do to my Lily if I ever misbehaved, how he would trap her and skin her alive. He told me how he'd do it, too, how he'd hang her by her feet, then cut her jugular and carotid veins with a blade so that she'd bleed to death. Then, with slow, deliberate movements, he sliced his cold fingers against my throat, so I knew exactly what he meant. He used words like sinews and corpuscles, words that I didn't know, but they scared me nonetheless. Funny how thinking about that god of Joseph's and of all the things Joseph would do to Lily if I was bad somehow made me feel safer inside that home. Staring out at the boys on their bikes and the girls with their chalk. Kids like me who had no idea what was going on inside Joseph and Miriam's home. To them, we were just the odd ducks on the block. What Mama used to call old Mrs. Waters from down the street. The widow, who walked around talking to her dead husband as if she were chatting on the phone. I imagined those kids out that window. The kids with the bikes and the chalk. And their own mamas and daddies telling them never to play with Isaac and Matthew, because they were weird. Not to talk to Joseph, because he was an odd duck. And then later, when all was said and done, it would be those mamas and daddies who told police that they felt something funny was going on inside our home, all along. They felt that something wasn't quite right. Something they couldn't put their finger on. But they didn't do a thing. About it.
Heidi. I slip from bed once Chris leaves, quiet so as not to wake Zoe from sleep. Beside me, she sleeps like a newborn, on her back, arms up in the air, the starfish position, the rising sun casting a golden hue across her face. I watch her sleep, the sass and defiance at bay for a time. Her features relaxed, her lips flirting with a smile. I wonder what it is that she dreams about, as she lets out a sigh and rolls over onto her side, taking the warm spot on the ivory sheets where my body has just been. I reach for the comforter from the end of the bed and pull it over her shoulders, closing the blinds so the impending sunlight stays out of her eyes. I walk into the hall, pulling the door to, and find my feet traipsing across the hall to the closed office door, my hand coming to rest on the satin nickel knob. I press my ear to the door and listen for signs of movement, of which there are none. My heart beats loudly, quickly in my chest. My palms begin to perspire. I'm overwhelmed with a sudden need, a very basic human need, like food, shelter, clothing. I need to hold that baby in my arms. There's no logic as I set my sweaty palm on that satin nickel knob, only an instinct, a reflex, some innate behavior. I know that I shouldn't, and yet I do. I turn the knob silently, astonished to find it unlocked. An omen. They lay side by side on the pull-out couch. Willow and the baby. A green chenille throw covering their bodies. Willow has her back turned to the baby, a pillow set over her head as if trying to tune out the sound of midnight cries or coos, or maybe Chris's early morning shower before he departed for New York. Willow breathes deeply, evidence of a deep sleep. I tiptoe across the room, cursing a cat who follows me in, scampering under the sofa bed for a place to hide. The drapes are drawn, keeping the outside world out. Tiny bands of light sneaking in through the opening in the middle. Lustrous early morning light tinged with pink and gold. In her deep sleep, Willow fails to notice the way my feet tread lightly across the carpeted room. And in my mind, I'm envisioning no Willow, no sleeper sofa. Just a beautiful baby in a bassinet waiting for someone to arrive. The baby's eyes are wide awake when I finally adjust to the darkness of the room and can see her clearly. She is staring with wonderment at the white ceiling. And when she sees me, she smiles. Her legs start kicking in excitement, her arms flailing wildly about. I slip my hands under the weight of her body and lift her from the bed. Willow lets out a sleepy sigh but doesn't open her eyes. I press that baby to my chest, my lips to her head, and together we walk out of the room. I settle into the rocking chair with the baby. "There now," I utter aloud, swaying rhythmically with the baby on my lap. I count her fingers. I count her toes. I run my hand across her silken head and breathe in the silence of the room. Silent save for the steady tick-tock of a wooden wall clock, its distressed white finish and Roman numerals just barely visible in the light of the rising sun. Outside, the sun begins its ascent over Lake Michigan, turning the east-facing sides of the buildings a golden hue. There are clouds in the sky. Cottony clouds, in shades of silver and pink, a pale pink clutching the edges of the clouds. A flock of birds flies through the sky, sparrows, I assume, and a mourning dove perches on the edge of the wooden balcony, staring in through the bay window, watching me. The baby and me, its beady eyes stare, its small head tilting from side to side, side to side, asking a question only it knows. The street below is quiet, just the occasional early morning pedestrian headed to work or out for a jog. The city bus passes by, quickly, not bothering to stop at the vacant bus stops. Taxis soar by without pause. I press my bare feet to the hardwood floors and force the chair back and forth, back and forth. Aware of the way the baby presses her face to my flannel pajamas, rummaging around for food, for a nipple from which to feed, like a hungry, suckling piglet pressing its way into its mother's teat to drink. I was a firm believer in breastfeeding Zoe when I still could. Chris and I never truly talked about it. It was something I planned to do, and Chris wasn't about to argue. My breastfeeding Zoe meant there would be no midnight feedings for him, no hungry baby awakening him in the middle of the night. He could sleep the night clear through, while Zoe and I sat together on a glider in her nursery for hours on end. There were many benefits to breastfeeding, everything from financial benefits to breast milk's ability to fight disease, though Chris eyeballed me squeamishly whenever I nursed. But for me, it was also about convenience. It was far more convenient for those late-night feedings to simply place baby Zoe on my breast and let her eat to her heart's content. There was no need to prepare bottles, to wash bottles, and more than anything else, I felt an intimacy to my newborn, an indispensability that I haven't felt from Zoe in many, many years now. She needed me. As she needed me to rock her to sleep, to change your diaper. But unlike those things, this, breastfeeding, was the one thing only I could provide for her. It was something only I could give. I planned to nurse until she was a year old, and then I planned to wean her from the breast. But once I fell ill and caring for my own health became a priority, my plans changed. Zoe's breastfeeding was quickly discontinued, and she was forced onto a formula-filled bottle, something that she didn't take too well. There was a part of me half certain that she, my baby, resented me for the sudden change, for the fact that I never asked her opinion before thrusting a silicone nipple in her mouth. She would scream when I did, refusing to latch on to the foreign object, refusing to drink the foreign milk. In time, she learned to adapt, of course, through trial and error, a half dozen types of bottles and nipples, a half dozen brands of formula, until we found one she could consume, one which didn't upset her stomach, one she didn't refuse. But Willow, I think completely cognizant of the way the baby roots around in the pleats of my shirt, I've never seen Willow breastfeed. Why, then, is the baby exploring the shirt of my flannel pajamas for a nipple? The agitation brimming in her tiny little body because she can't make her way past the clear plastic buttons to find my breast. But I don't have the time to think it through, to come up with a list of sensible scenarios, like engorgement or an inadequate milk supply. Because there she is, Willow, standing before me in the room. Her long hair sweeps across her face so that all I can see are her eyes, moody and mistrusting eyes, which fall on me like meteors from the sky. Eyes that make me suddenly wonder how virtuous this girl is, how trustworthy. And once again my thoughts go to the blood on the undershirt. She says, "You took the baby. You took Ruby from my room." And I say calmly, "Yes, I did." And then I think fast for some excuse. "She was crying." I lie. It's instantaneous, spontaneous, far too easy a thing to do. "I didn't want her to wake you," I say. "I was up anyway, just about to start a pot of coffee, when I heard her crying." "She's hungry," Willow says to me, her voice soft, watching as I watch the baby paw at my chest. "Yes," I say, "I was just about to make her a bottle." But Willow says with a sureness I'm certain I've never heard from her before, "I'll do it," and her eyes stray to the coffee maker. Yesterday's remains now syrupy and cold. "You haven't had your coffee," she says. And I tell myself she is simply being helpful, doing her share. I tell myself there isn't an edge to her voice as she gropes the baby awkwardly and removes her from my lap. Suddenly, I feel as if something has been taken from me, something that was mine. Perhaps Willow isn't as wide-eyed and green as she's led me to believe. She's taken the baby and now stands in my kitchen, baby thrust to a hip, holding her awkwardly as she tries to prepare a bottle, as the baby wriggles ferociously in her arms, her eyes glistening with tears. The baby stares at me, her arms reaching past Willow for me, I'm just sure of it, as I remain on the rocking chair, unable to rise and make my coffee because I can think of nothing but wanting that baby returned to me. My blood pressure is rising, sweat pooling under my arms, sticking to the flannel. I feel suddenly unable to breathe, unable to find enough oxygen to fill up my lungs. The baby is staring at me, her eyes still, though everything else is flailing about. Her feet kick at Willow. Her hands pull madly on Willow's sepia-toned hair. The baby's skin has turned a beet red, and at Willow's sluggishness, she begins to scream. Willow takes the abuse as if she barely notices, and yet it makes her clumsy, makes her knock the formula-filled bottle to the floor, the white powder creeping its way into the cracks of the floorboards. And I could help. I could. But I find I'm frozen still, like a statue, my body glued to the rocking chair, my eyes locked on the baby's. A door parts from down the hall, followed by the sound of Zoe's voice, half asleep and annoyed, the child who once clung to my breast needing me and only me. Now she didn't want a thing to do with me. "Doesn't anybody sleep around here?" she asks, peeked. Not making eye contact with Willow or me as she emerges into sight. I manage a "good morning" my voice breathless, as Zoe slides drunkenly down the hall, the strands of her auburn hair in a complete state of lawlessness and anarchy. Zoe says nothing. She drops to the sofa and flips on the TV, MTV, the preteen equivalent to caffeine. "And good morning to you, too," I mutter to myself, sarcastically. My eyes staring at the baby with longing, craving another chance to do this right.
Willow. Ms. Flores asks to know more about Matthew. Just talking about Matthew somehow brings a smile to my face. I don't say anything, but Ms. Flores sees that smile and says to me, "You like Matthew, don't you?" And suddenly that smile goes away. Just like that. "Matthew is my friend," I say. I tell her about Matthew passing by my room at night, about how he left the books under my mattress so I didn't turn into a dimwit like Miriam. But that was before. Matthew was 6 years older than me. He was 15 when I came to live in that home in Omaha. I was 9. It wasn't too long before he was done with school, and by the time I was 12 or 13, maybe 14, he'd moved out of the house. Just one day when Joseph was at work, he packed up his things and decided to leave. But he didn't go far. Instead of going to college like his friends were doing, Matthew couldn't afford college. He worked at the gas station down the road. And for a while, instead of bringing books for me like he did when he was in school, he brought candy bars and bags of chips when he came to visit, the kinds of foods Joseph swore were the devil's creation. I didn't know where Matthew slept at night. He didn't talk about it much. Sometimes he'd talk about living in a big, tall brick building with an air conditioner and a big screen TV, but even I knew he was lying. Other days it might be that he was traveling down the Missouri River in a barge. He just didn't want me to feel bad for him, is all. But of course, anything would be better than living there, in that home with Joseph and Miriam. With Isaac, whose own eyes had started to have that same thirst I saw in Joseph's the nights he came into my room. But still, sometimes, Matthew would come to the home in Omaha on the days when Isaac was at school, and Joseph was at work, and Miriam, of course, was in her own room, oblivious to the world around her. He'd tell me how he might just join the army, how he was making more than I might think in that gas station down the street. But even I could tell how his eyes looked tired, how sometimes he smelled as though he hadn't bathed for days, how his clothes always smelled, how sometimes he'd nap on that bed of mine while I washed a shirt or a pair of his jeans, or scavenged the cabinets for something for him to eat. Every now and then he'd search around that house for some money, a dollar bill here, some forgotten coins there, and he'd stuff them in a pocket, and I came to believe that Matthew was getting by on that money alone, on whatever money he could steal from Joseph. Once he found a $20 bill in the pocket of an old coat Joseph didn't wear anymore, and I could see in Matthew's eyes it was as if he'd struck gold. Matthew wanted to get me out of the house. I knew he did. He just didn't know how, is all. One day he swore, when he had more money. Like Mama, Matthew was starting to talk a lot about one day. One day he'd have enough money. One day he'd get me far, far away from there. I thought about Joseph and Miriam getting paid to foster me, and I wished that maybe Matthew could foster me instead. But that was the child in me talking. The real me knew nothing like that would ever happen. I could tell that something was changing in Matthew. He talked about bigger things than cockroaches and Venus now. He talked about getting me out of that house, away from Joseph. Homeless people living on the city's streets. Matthew continued to bring books for me that he picked up at the public library. I fantasized about that library. About the fact that without any money, you could read all the hundreds of thousands of books for free. Matthew told me about it time and again, about the 4 floors of nothing but books.
and I wondered how long it would take me to read them all. Matthew would bring a book or two when he came by to visit, and let me keep them until the next time. And when I finished the cleaning and the laundry, and I had taken out the trash, I would lie down on my bed and read from the pages of whatever it was that Matthew had brought. Matthew and I would perch together on the edge of my bed, sometimes him looking too big for my room, like a full-size man trying to squeeze into a doll's house, and together we would read. I could tell that Matthew was changing from the boy who used to stop by my room and tell me about Venus and dumb stuff about bugs. He was filling out, no longer a broomstick, but now a man. His voice was lower, his eyes much more complicated than I remembered in the days when he and Isaac would walk home from school, staring down at the concrete, trying hard to ignore the punches they received. I felt like something was changing in me, too. I felt different around Matthew somehow. Nervous, like I'd only ever been that first time he came into my room, when I wasn't sure what he was there to do. Matthew looked at me like no one in the world ever had. He talked to me like no one had since Mama and Daddy. We'd read together from this book or that, my favorite being Anne of Green Gables, one I must have asked Matthew 100 times to get from that 4-story library. And when we got to a hard word I didn't know how to say, Matthew would help me with it. And never did he give me that look like I was dumb. I learned a lot in those books about science and nature, about how unstable air caused thunderstorms, about how in some parts of the world, thunderstorms happened every day, about how lightning was actually good for people and plants, not something to fear. I started wondering if Joseph was wrong, about the fire and brimstone and all that stuff. I started thinking that maybe when the thunderstorms rattled across the land, shaking the living daylights out of our small Omaha home, it wasn't God coming for me because he was mad. It was just a thunderstorm after all. But I didn't dare tell Joseph. One day, Matthew arrived with burns on his arms and hands, the skin raw and red and blistery. I could tell that it hurt, the way he cradled one hand in the other, one of his forearms wrapped up in a gauze bandage. He came into the house, quiet-like, like maybe he wasn't sure I should see. I gasped when I saw him, hurrying into the kitchen to get him a bag of ice. What he told me was there was a fire at the shelter where he was staying. When I asked him where he was staying, he said a homeless shelter. I thought of Mama collecting our old clothes for the homeless, but otherwise, that word didn't have a whole lot of meaning to me. I thought of Matthew wearing someone's old clothes, sleeping on someone's old bedspread, and the thought made me feel sad. I knew Matthew wasn't lying about the homeless shelter, because when he told me about it, he actually looked at me. But when he told me about riding barges on the Missouri River, he looked away, at the peeling wallpaper in my room, or the old paint that lay hidden beneath. He had a bag with him, stuffed near full with everything he owned. He said he wouldn't be going back to that or any other homeless shelter ever again. He was through. At first he didn't tell me exactly what happened to give him those burns, but he did tell me about the shelter itself, how it was too crowded, how there weren't enough beds for everyone, how some nights he had to sleep on the floor. How he kept his belongings tucked beneath his bed, feeling lucky if they were still there come morning. He told me about the rows of identical bunk beds, with the gaunt mattresses and mismatching bedspreads, some stained and torn, others brand new. Donated, Matthew told me, because they weren't good enough for the rest of the world. And I could see in his eyes that that's how he felt. Not good enough for the rest of the world. And I wanted to tell him that it wasn't true. He said that the others there, they were drug addicts and drunks, and the people that ran the place, they couldn't care less. He told me that in order to get clean sheets or a square meal, sometimes he had to do things he didn't want to do. Like what? I asked. You don't want to know, he said. And then he told me what happened there, in that homeless shelter, to give him those burns. He didn't tell me because I asked. because I didn't ask. I wasn't sure I wanted to know that either. He told me about a fire. Maybe faulty electric wiring, he said, but more likely arson. I asked him what that meant, arson, and he said someone was upset when there wasn't enough room in the shelter for them to stay, and so they took a match to the place and torched it, he said, leaving two dead, a man and his 10-year-old son. The fire escapes were barred with beds and belongings, so that there was only one way in or out. I looked hard at those burns, the red skin that bulged from his hands. I pictured a building consumed in fire the way Matthew said it was, the walls left black and charred, everything inside burned to a crisp. This picture made me think of that place Joseph told me about, the one where sinners go. Hell. A place of never-ending punishment and torture with demons and dragons and the devil himself. Eternal punishment. Lakes of fire. Fiery furnace. Unquenchable fire. Fire, fire, fire. And I decided then and there that I wouldn't ever step foot in a homeless shelter. Didn't even matter that I didn't know what a homeless shelter really was. Where did Matthew stay after he left that shelter? Ms. Flores asks, her voice tearing me away from my thoughts. I'm thinking about Matthew and a complicated look that had developed in his eyes, one which I liked, the brown somehow browner, warmer, like the syrup Mama poured on our hot fudge sundaes. That's what I thought of Matthew's eyes. Warm and sweet, like hot fudge, rich and delicious. Claire, she says, are you listening to me? But before I can answer, a phone rings, and Ms. Flores dives her hands deep into the pocket of a bag and sets it free. She gazes at the screen, her eyebrows wrinkling up like raisins. She skids her chair back from the table abruptly, making me jump. Stop there, she says. We'll talk about Matthew in a minute. And then, to the boy in the corner, watch her. I'll be back. And with that, excuses herself from the cold room, the sound of her heels clattering down the concrete floor. When she's gone, the barred door sealed shut by a second guard who follows her out of view, the boy in the corner whispers to me, if it was me, I would have killed him too.
Heidi. In the morning, there's a knock at the door. Zoe is in her bedroom, preparing for the school day, getting dressed, brushing her hair and such. Willow is in the bathroom. I pass by en route to the front door, the knock beckoning me from the master bedroom, where I've partially dressed in a pair of tweed pants and a cami, a cardigan left abandoned on my bed. My hair is wet, drying more quickly than I'd like. I tote the baby on a hip, seeing that Willow has left the bathroom door slightly ajar as I pass by. I catch a glimpse of her in the reflection of the bathroom mirror, staring at her own image. Her hair, like mine, is still wet from a shower, dripping idle drops onto a shirt of Zoe's. There is dark eyeliner placed on a single eye. She leans in close to the mirror to plant it on the second eye, but instead hesitates and pulls down the front of Zoe's vintage wash shirt, far down, to the tender skin around her breast. I feel myself gasp for breath, willing the baby to remain silent. She runs her fingers over a lesion right there on the milky white skin, so close to the areola that I can see where the pigment changes color. It's instinctive when I lean in, desperate for a better look of what appears to be teeth marks, the imprint of incisors and canines, teeth pressed hard enough to leave a mark, hard enough to deface the skin forever. And then another knock, and I jump, moving quickly through the hall so that Willow doesn't have a chance to see my mouth, gaping open at the sight of her scar, so that she won't see me. Graham stands on the opposite side of the door. In his hands are two mugs of coffee, an outline of the Chicago skyline printed on their surface. Upon seeing the baby, he slips past me in the doorway and sets the mugs of coffee on the kitchen table. "So this is who I'm to thank for the ruckus these past few nights," he says. "You didn't tell me you had company coming.